Today, in part 8 of our series, The Story, we pursue the good life, as revealed in the book of Judges. Again, God wants to be with us, and will pay any price to make it so. But how can we break the cycle of sin and replace our commitment to the good life over relationship with God? Here's Pastor Seth.
The book of Judges, the theme for that book is stated this way. And the people did what was right in their own eyes. The people did what was right in their own eyes. Now, in our current culture today, that sounds like a good idea. But in the Bible, when the Bible says the people did what was right in their own eyes, that was a scathing rebuke on human nature. Because the whole theme of Judges says, theme is when you do, when people do what is right in their own eyes, trouble follows. That is the book of Judges. Reading the book of Judges is kind of a downer. I mean, if you read the book of Joshua the week before, you think, man, that's great. The people are finally in the promised land after a 600-year time of span, all the way back to Abraham, right up to the time of Joshua, the invasion. And you're reading about victories in the northern campaign and victories in the central campaign and victories in the southern campaign. The people are finally in the promised land. Joshua dies. You turn to Judges, and the book of Judges is one long death spiral of human nature down, down, down over a period of over 300 years. There are 12 different judges mentioned. When you think of judges, this is not judges like our Supreme Court judges. This was before the nation had a king. These would be sort of like a governor or a mayor or somebody that's raised up for a particular point in time when the country needs him, and he is sort of the key fella to get something to overcome some trouble that is in the land. As we look at the book of Judges, this is the seventh book in the Old Testament, and the theme of our story is God's upper story all the way back to Genesis 1 and up through Judges so far, is God wants to be with us and will pay any price to make it so. If you've been with us for the series, what you've seen is God continues to move towards his people while his people continue to move away from him. In spite of the misery and distress that they bring upon themselves in doing so. In chapter 2, we pick up the cycle of what happens through about 12 generations of people. You're going to hear from, if you read the book, from about 12 different judges, 6 by name only and 6 by story. We'll pick up one of those stories in just a minute, the story of Gideon. But the general cycle of sin, we'll pick up in Judges chapter 2, verse 10. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, that's the end of Joshua, and Joshua dies. That generation that took the land, they die. Another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. And when I think about that particular statement, as a lover of American history, I think about this statement here. It's happening right in front of our eyes. A generation who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. Now, Baal in that part of the world is a generic term for almost any god that the people wanted to make up. And there were lots of Baals. It was usually the Baal of sun, or the bale of moon, or the bale of sowing, or the bale of reaping, or the bale of harvest, or if you wanted sons to help you with the farming and with herding, you had the bale of fertility, hopefully to get some more sons to work the fields with you. There's almost any kind of bale that they wanted to get, is the idea. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they no longer were able to resist. When God was with them in the book of Joshua, they won almost every victory, except one, which we looked at, the loss at Ai. When Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. Just as Moses had warned them in the book of Deuteronomy, if my people disobey God and you go out to fight, you're going to find I'm not with you and you're going to lose battles. Joshua, at the end of the book of Joshua, told the people the same thing. It's a warning. And they did not heed that warning, and they ended up going through all kinds of distress because of it. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those raiders. Verse 17, yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned away from the way in which the fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived, for the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judges died, the people started the cycle all over again. The people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Now, that part in Judges 2 is sort of a, here's the plot line for the rest of the book. Be ready to look for this particular, how this happens. In what we think of as a cycle of sin. And there are four parts of this cycle. And if you're a note taker, you want to jot down these four D words. The cycle starts off with, the people were supposed to obey God, but they disobey. They turn away from God and his way. That's the first cycle of sin. They disobey. And the second thing is that distress happens. Some kind of distress happens. And then the third thing is they finally look up and they say, do something. And then God delivers. And it looks like the people are going to be moving in the direction they're supposed to. But the cycle begins again when they disobey. Now that their life is going well again, they disobey to a point to where there's more distress. And they get so broken down, they say, do something. And God delivers. And life starts to go well again. And they disobey again. And the cycle goes on all the way through the book of Judges for about 12 different cycles. Now, as you read the book of Judges, it's going to be a little confusing. Because you're going to wonder, you know, God, am I reading this right? That there's a system of reward and punishment? If the people do good, you reward them. Kind of a quid pro quo. And if they do bad, you punish them. Is that what I'm supposed to get from the book of Judges? It may read like that. It may seem like that. But that is not what I'm supposed to get from the book of Judges. Because if there is a system of reward and punishment, it did not do a good job of changing human nature. About the best you might be able to say about the system of reward and punishment is that it may have turned human nature towards the good a little, but certainly not for very long. But it seems to me that a clear reading of the book of Judges is all that the system of reward and punishment did was it deepened the sense of entitlement that I should have the life that I'm supposed to have and I could have, and that God should cooperate in doing that. Now, that's evidenced by the continuing downward cycle through the book of Judges. For the first 18 chapters of Judges, you have all these stories. The writer uses the last three chapters to describe sort of the bottom of the cesspool of human nature during that period of time. If you have the stomach for it, read the last three chapters of Judges. It's hard to read those last three chapters. Now, the people continue this cycle over and over and over again. And one of the questions that you ask as you read this is why? They had Moses. They had the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. Did they not read that or study that? Did they not hear or remember Moses' words in Deuteronomy about this or Joshua's words? Well, they probably did. Why do they keep disobeying and starting the same cycle of disobedience, distress, do something, and deliverance, why didn't they stop somewhere along the way? And as I read this, I think it was because down deep in their heart, they had a goal that was known to them, probably not even known to them. And that is, there was something that was driving them that made sense to them, where disobedience made sense. And that is this: the drive for the good life. However you define the good life for you, or however they define the good life for them, if that's your top goal, and you're trying to obey God and do what he says to do, but you're not getting the good life as you define good life, then suddenly you're going to question obedience, and maybe disobedience doesn't sound like such a bad idea. Maybe that's what I need to do to get the life that I want. That's what I read as I read the book of Judges. Now, how do we get the good life? And it appears to me, just as I observe my own life and the life of people that I know, there seem to be sort of three stages that we go through. The first stage is what I think of as the managed life. When you're young, you know, I know what to do. That's the managed life. I know what to do. I went off to college. I knew how to be happy, or so I thought. I knew how to have fun on the weekends. When you get married, I know how to be happily married. I know how to be a good husband. I know how to be a good wife. You have kids. I know how to parent. You have teenagers. I know how to be a good parent to teens. You get your first job. I know how to be a good employee. You get your first raise. I know how to handle finances. There are just all kinds of things that happen that we just naturally just assume, I know what to do. I got it. Don't need anybody to tell me how to do this. I got it. That's the managed life. And we all start there. Whether you're Christian or non-Christian, religious or irreligious, doesn't matter. The managed life seems like the way to go. After a while, though, for some of us, after a while, you start to wonder how well the managed life is actually working. Am I getting the good life that I think I deserve? And after a while, I start to think, I don't think so. Apparently, I'm missing something along the way. For me, my junior year in college was kind of one of this time when I thought, my way of getting the good life is not working. And I ended up, what a lot of Christians end up with is the blessed life. The blessed life. Now, I came to Christ partly because of my sin, the need for forgiveness, and I wanted to spend eternity in heaven, and it seemed to me that I was on the way to hell the way I was living, and I'm glad for that. But within a few short weeks of that, it seemed like that the commitment to the good life as my top priority was still in place in my heart. It had not been dislodged or even challenged. And so the blessed life was something along this line: tell me what to do, God, and I'll do it. With the assumption that if I do what you tell me to do, that I will get the blessed life. And tell me the things I'm supposed to avoid so that I'll not torpedo the good life. But after a while of trying to live the blessed life, it doesn't seem to be working like I thought it was supposed to be. And then I begin to question, well, is God at fault here? Well, no, God's not at fault. Could it be me? Well, no, it couldn't be me. It's my husband. It's my wife. It's my kids. It's my teenagers. It's my boss. It's my pastor. It's my church. It's my small group leader. It's the person I have to work next to. Next cubicle. The blessed life, there's something flawed with that. It doesn't seem to be as seamless as we thought it would be. The last part is the wounded life. And the wounded life, I think of as two compartments. One of them is, I may not be able to get the good life like I thought I was going to get, but at least I want to feel like I have the good life. And this spurs all kinds of what we call addictions. There's a whole host of things that people get involved with in the hope of at least feeling something like the good life, even if I can't have the good life as I define it. Or the wounded life is more relational as opposed to solitary. Relational in that I hope that people will see how much I struggle and how hard life is, and that there will be some people who will come along and care for me. And they will validate me. And they will say, you know, we're behind you, Seth. And we're with you in this. You know, life's been hard for you. And at least I'll have a taste of what it is that I hoped I would get in the good life through my woundedness. Now, what should be apparent is that none of those things are good things to do. And that what God is trying to do is, no matter which of these three types of life we're trying to do, what he's trying to do is get us back to this place of the good life as our central priority and said, this is where the cancer started. And you're not going to make any hay until this changes. The commitment to the good life over living for God, loving him, serving him, no matter how my life looks or how, no matter how good or bad my life happens to look at any given time. All right, so that's sort of the big picture of Judges. Now I want to look at one particular fella, Gideon. By far my favorite person in the Old Testament. I love Gideon. Gideon, I relate to Gideon. We were separated at birth. I'm not quite as old as Gideon. But I believe he's my distant brother somewhere. I pick up the story in Judges chapter 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Now, the people didn't call to God for 7 years when they were under oppression. It's kind of an interesting thought there. Imagine if we had been invaded by the Russians and we were under the oppression of the Russians. Would it take us 7 years to call out to God if we were having to live up at Big Bear in caves and hovels? I wonder why it took so long. Just a thought. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land, they ruined the crops all the way to Gaza, and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. That's what they were living for 7 years. Now, the next verse, Judges 6:6, says this. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. Now, I suspect if I'd been those folks, I'd been under oppression for 7 years by the Midianites, I would have called out for help. And you probably would have called out for help too. That makes sense if the central purpose in life is the good life. Then, of course, when I'm in distress, I'm going to do what 12 generations of Israelites did. I'm going to call out for help. Do something. But what if the problem for my distress has nothing to do with the Midianites? It has nothing to do with the oppression that I'm in or my distress. What if the real problem for my dilemma is my disobedience? And what if my central purpose in life to get the good life is my central problem that God is trying to disrupt? How would this sentence end if I saw that? Midian had so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for mercy, forgiveness, a spirit of repentance. That's something very, very different than calling out for help. Now, they call out to help, and there are different times in my life where I've called out to God for help, either for good reasons or not so good reasons. And sometimes it appears to me that God sends the kind of help that I want, and sometimes it seems to me that God sends the help I'm really not looking for. And I believe this was the case with the people here. Verse 7, when the Israelites cried to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet. Now, imagine that if there were, I don't know, if we were all up somewhere around Big Bear, Lake Arrowhead, living in hovels and caves and tents, and we were afraid on any given day the Midianites would come up into the hills and take whatever crops and food we had. Imagine if we called out to God for help. The kind of help we would be looking for is, can you send us General Patton? We need somebody that can kind of pick up the spirits of all the people and rally us together as an army, a force. And when the Midianites come up, we can defend our territory, defend our homes, defend our land, defend our crops. A general. General Patton would be good. Why would God send them a prophet? If our central purpose in life was the good life, we would expect him to send a general. If the central purpose of life was not the good life, and if my central problem was a heart that continued to turn away from God and to disobey in everyday life, then the kind of help I would need is a prophet. Now imagine we're all up there, up in Big Bear, or you're up there, you're calling out to help, and suddenly somebody like me shows up. Well, Seth, we're glad you're here. It's a good gesture. But we need somebody with more military experience than you do. You know, playing paintball a few times in your life, that was good. You know, but the stakes are a little bit higher here. He sends them a prophet, verse 8. Here's what the prophet told the people. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. And then this sounds so much like the story that we've been studying, sort of the high points he reminds the people of. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them before you and gave you their land. This is the book of Joshua. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me. Disobedience makes sense when the central purpose of my life is the good life. Until that is uprooted, become aware of it, repent of it, live for something other than that, this is the cycle I'm going to continue to live in. Now we pick up Gideon. Verse 11, the angel of the Lord came out and sat down under the oak in Ophrah, not the Oprah on TV, that belonged to Joash, the Abizrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. Now, this is the first picture we have of Gideon. And I love this first picture of Gideon because you think, we got a general here. He's going to rally the troops, get the army together. But the first picture we have of Gideon is somebody who is timid. A coward. Sort of, he's threshing wheat, which is he's being responsible to help create some food here, but he's doing it in a wine press. Why would he be doing it in a wine press? Because probably it's out of growing season with grapes and the making of wine, and the Midianites surely wouldn't think to go to a wine press to see if there's some food somewhere. That's sort of the first image we have here of Gideon, sort of the Pee Wee Herman of life. Verse 12, the second person God sends shows up. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Now, I have to tell you, every time I read that verse, I just laugh. Because apparently, the Spirit of God or the angel of God has different glasses when he looks out than I do. I would never use this phrase, "Oh, mighty warrior," you know, "Oh, Lord is with you, mighty warrior." That's not how it appears to me. But you know, when you read this, apparently the angel of the Lord sees something I don't see, and that is apparently the first part of this verse of what he says rolls into the second part of the verse. The Lord is with you, maybe what's behind mighty warrior. He certainly doesn't feel like a mighty warrior, doesn't seem like he's a mighty warrior. Gideon himself is going to agree with this assessment in just a few moments. He does not seem like he's a, a warrior at all. Now, a lot of you know Mindy's a kindergarten teacher. And, you know, when your wife is a kindergarten teacher, she just comes home with some great stories. There was a little five-year-old this past week that came up and said, "Mrs. Gatchel, my mother is going to pick me up early from school today." "Really? Well, why is that? Do you have a dentist appointment?" He said, "No, I have Navy SEAL training." Navy SEAL training. Little five-year-old. Maybe that's Gideon. That's what I read here. "Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Here's what the great mighty warrior says, verse 13. "But sir, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." Now, to Gideon, those questions and statements make perfect sense to him. And the reason they make perfect sense is because he, like all the people at that time, had the same central goal in life, the good life. And when the good life is not happening, then it appears to him that maybe God has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. Now, he's partly right about that, but not for the reason he thinks. If the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? The first part of his question there is the tip-off. If the Lord is with us, why has this happened to us? Is a reflection of my central purpose in life is the good life, and if I don't have it, there must be something wrong with what God's doing. So what do you do? What do you do if this is your guy that's going to lead the people, and this guy is fraught with doubt and has the wrong central purpose in his life? What do? Do you give him a pep talk? Do you give him a sermon? Do you rebuke him? I love what God does here. "The Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?'" He doesn't deal with any of his doubts, doesn't deal with any of his questions. He just gives him marching orders. And what I like about this is it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback when you don't have to be on the field. You can sit back like I did watching the Baylor game yesterday and question some of the stupid things that you watch out there and the things that go through your head. Man, if I had been there, if I'd been the coach, if I'd been the offensive coordinator, if I'd been the defensive coordinator, if I'd been the quarterback. That's a whole different thing when the coach puts you in the game to play quarterback. Or when suddenly you have to make all those calls yourself as the coach. And this is what happens to Gideon. "But Lord," suddenly he's backpedaling. "How can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I am the least in my family. I am the Pee Wee Herman. You couldn't have picked the worst person to do this." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike then all the Midianites together." The only assurance he gives him is his presence and his marching orders. Go. Now, the next assignment he gives to him is not what I would do. If I was God, I would say, okay, we've got this timid guy, not very strong. He's going to have to lead this amazing revolution here. So let's give Gideon a few little projects that are doable. And maybe he can get some momentum. And maybe 5 years from now or 10 years from now, he'll be up for this challenge. That's not what God does. God gives him a death-defying challenge. He says, "I want you to go back home, and you're going to tear down your father's altar to Baal that's up at the top of the hill." Now, he knows that if he does that, the men in the town are going to lynch him. He was right about that. So he goes up under the cover of darkness, does it in the night, and then goes into hiding, which is sort of in character with Gideon. One of the reasons I love Gideon. He obeyed, but under his own terms. And then the next thing, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Gideon and says, "Call out the soldiers." The word goes out, 32,000 men show up. Seems like a lot of soldiers, 32,000. Maybe we can do something. But if you're fighting a force of 120,000, which is what the Midianites were, you're outgunned almost 4-1. God, I don't know if this is really going to work. And God comes to Gideon and says, you know, you're right. We have a problem. Gideon, yeah, thank you. But God says, we have too many soldiers. Wait a minute. I took some pre-med math, and your math and my math aren't the same. Now I got too many guys. Said, tell everybody that's here of the 32,000 that if they're quaking with fear, tell them it's okay, just go home. What? Do it. If you're afraid, you can go home. Kind of surprised Gideon wasn't one of the ones that went home. Of the 32,000 that were there, 22,000 said, see ya, and off they went. 10,000 remained. Now we're outgunned 12-1, not 4-1, 12-1. God comes to him and says, Gideon, we have another problem. I think this time Gideon said, oh, no, we're good, you know, no problem, everything's fine. Nah, we still got too many soldiers. I want you to tell everybody to go get a drink of water. And the guys that kneel down at the river there to drink water, tell those guys to go home. And everybody that reaches down with their hand and takes the water and laps it out of their hand like a dog, those guys stay. He gives them the instructions. 10,000 men go to get water. When it's all said and done, 9,700 were on their knees. And they're shipped out back home. Now think about this. 300 left. Think about this. For every 3 guys that stayed, 100 walked out the door. You got Charlie, you got Billy, you got Aaron. And 100 walk out the door. You got Fred, you got Gus, you got Harry. Another 100 out the door. Now instead of being outgunned 12-1, they're outgunned 400-1. God says, perfect. Now, as I read that story, I'm sort of haunted by a thought or a question, and that is, God, have you dealt with me in sort of the same way in my adult life? Are there bigger challenges that I've had to face that are over my head, clearly over my head? But instead of propping me up like I think you should or adding more resources, you seem to be taking resources away? And I have to tell you that as I read, this is one of the reasons why I love the story, is there are many times in my life where it seems like this is what God did with Gideon, he's done with me. Now, very soon after that, Gideon sneaks down into the Midianite camp at night and hears two guys talking. One of them has a dream, and the one Midianite tells the other Midianite about this dream. And it's clear to the Midianite from this dream that Gideon, who Gideon may wonder how he ever even heard of him, that Gideon is going to win the victory. It's one of these moments of, oh my gosh, it really is true. Gideon goes up the hill. He gets his 300 men together. And then sort of like the Battle of Jericho, where they have trumpets. Every guy's got a trumpet. But this time they've all got these clay jars with a torch inside. He puts 100 on all the way down the left side of the Midianites on the ambush. And 100 down the right side of the camp for an ambush in the dead of night. And 100 at the top of the hill. And at the sound, they all break their trump. They break their jar. The torches appear to almost surround the Midianites. The trumpets blare. The men shout out for the Lord and for Gideon. And these soldiers who are dead asleep wake up in the darkness of the camp and begin to slaughter one another in a panic. And the rout continues for the next few hours through the dawn. They head south into the land of Ephraim. Gideon calls out for more soldiers to come and help with the rout. They turn east. All the Midianites who are left head towards the Jordan River. They cross over the Jordan River. Another call goes out for more soldiers, and the rout continues into the next day. These guys have been up all night, haven't eaten since dinner. When they get into the land of Ephraim during the chase, the Spirit of God in the book of Judges found it important to add several stories that are very annoying to read. They're very disruptive. I don't want to think I'm like this. I have the feeling that I am more than I wish I was. Chapter 8, verse 1. The 300 soldiers have made their way. They've been fighting for several hours. They make their way into Ephraim. Now the Ephraimites ask Gideon, "Why have you treated us like this? Why didn't you call us when you went to fight Midian?" And they criticized him sharply. Now think about this. The Ephraimites were the next tribe below where Gideon was. They had also been under oppression from the Midianites for 7 years. And the Ephraimites see the Midianite army running through Ephraim in a complete rout. Now, wouldn't you think that they would be pretty happy about this? Wouldn't you think they would just be so grateful to whoever was in charge of this and had this happening? And they would be thankful to God for this? And when they realize that it's this little guy, Gideon, from the tribe of Manasseh, a little clan up there, they would think, "Wow, that's great. Thank you so much for what you've done." That's not how they respond at all. Their response is virtually the opposite of that. They find a way to criticize him. Why didn't you call us? Now maybe they heard the call or maybe they didn't, but at the end of chapter 7, just before this, Gideon did make a call to Ephraim for soldiers. Whether they heard the call or not, they found a way to criticize him and to draw the worst possible conclusion about Gideon. "You're just doing this so you could hoard all the glory for yourself or all the plunder for yourself, and you've excluded us." Is my heart that small? Have I responded that way to people? These folks had the audacity to verbalize that. Maybe I don't verbalize that all the time, but are these thoughts in my head? It says they criticized him sharply. Gideon, to his credit, after having been up all night and been fighting for hours, flatters them in verse 2. And only after he flatters them does verse 3 say, "At this, their resentment against him subsided." Don't you just want to throw up? Verse 4. Gideon and his 300 men, exhausted, yet keeping up the pursuit, they kept going, came to the Jordan River and crossed it. He said to the men of Succoth, which is a Hebrew town on the east side of the Jordan, and though it's a Hebrew name, surely one of the worst English names of a town there probably could be, "Give my troops some bread. They are worn out, and I'm still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." But the officials of Succoth did just like the Ephraimites. "Do you already have the hands of these kings in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops?" There's countrymen. They've also been under the oppression of the Midianites for 7 years. Why would they respond this way? They would respond this way if their central goal in life is the good life and to feel good about me. Then it would make sense to criticize Gideon and to not give bread to their countrymen. From there, they went up to Peniel, another town east of the Jordan, one of the Israelites' towns, made the same request of them, but they answered as the men of Succoth had. Finally, the victory is complete. They had rest for 40 years, the land did. Gideon dies. What would be the response of the people to God and Gideon? Verse 33, "No sooner had Gideon died when the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals." The same central goal in life had not changed. The good life, and I want to feel good about me, is my highest priority. They set up Baal Berith, which means treaty or covenant. The people had made a covenant with the people out there to ensure the good life would stay intact. We won't attack you, you don't attack us. And they did not remember the Lord their God who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Gideon for all the good things he had done for them. When I think about the book of Judges, I think about the central question. What really, really, really is the central goal that I am pursuing in life? Is it the good life and to feel good about me? Is that really the highest thing? Or is it something very different? I want to love God and I want to serve God no matter how my life seems at any given moment, no matter whether I'm feeling great or terrible, whether I'm feeling like victorious or defeated, hopeful or hopeless. I want to reflect you well to the people in my life today. Is that more important than the good life? That's a very different answer. Let's pray together. Father, would you take the seeds of the book of Judges that we've looked at and the seeds of the story of Gideon that we've looked at today and plant them in our hearts? There may be some sprouts and buds that happen today or even now. But maybe there are some buds that are going to happen later on this week or in a few weeks or a month or two from now. I might have done something there. But Father, help us not to be like the people of the book of Judges. Help us to pursue you as our top priority, to love you and serve you, and to do that by loving well the people in our life in spite of ourselves and in spite of how we feel or how life seems in any given moment. And help us to be about that business today.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.